From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. A blue wave in 2018 sent several Southern California Democrats to the House, but 2020 hasn't been so kind. Later, a look at mask etiquette in the fall television lineup.
If you wanted to rank this show for its safety protocols, I'd put it somewhere between a Donald Trump rally and a Gavin Newsom dinner party.
That's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. Hey, you made it to Friday. Glad you could join us today. Coming up,
the social justice issue isn't just making sure they receive the vaccine. The social justice issue is really to try and decrease the vulnerability.
An argument for why the hardest hit communities in LA County should get a coronavirus vaccine first. That's ahead. But we kick things off, as we do every Friday, with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. This week, the results from the 2020 election are almost completely in for SoCal races, and it's great news for Republicans running for Congress. Plus, major flubs by state lawmakers who say the public should do one thing for their safety, but then secretly break those rules when no one's watching, or so they think. With us today is Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Hey, Marisa.
Hey, Austin.
Also with us is Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Hey to you, Zach.
Great to be with you, Austin.
Well, Election Day might have been over 2 weeks ago, or 2 years, give or take, but there's still one congressional race in Southern California up in the air, and that's the contest for the 25th Congressional District, which covers much of northern LA County. Republican Mike Garcia holds a lead over Democrat Christy Smith. That's so thin. How thin is it? It's LA's newest diet plan. Props to my producer, Leo Duran, for that one. Marisa Lagos, can you recap where we are at so far?
Well, I have a more scientific a way to characterize this race. It's as of the latest count on the Secretary of State site, 446 votes apart.
Wow.
So that is a thin margin, Austin. I mean, if you recall, this was the seat flipped by Katie Hill in 2018. She resigned about a year ago after some allegations over an affair really surfaced in right-wing media.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Garcia did win the special election to finish out her term, and then he and Christy Smith, a assemblywoman, kind of rematched for this. I think that obviously you're right. This was not great news for Democrats. It would have been better if they had kept all those seats they flipped in 2018. But this is a purple district, as are some of the other ones we're going to talk about. And I think that, you know, the really razor thin margins here is just show that these are, you know, places in California that I think are going to continue to be battlegrounds. Congressional seats are up every 2 years. And I think even if Garcia pulls it out, we will, I would expect to see a strong candidate, if not Christy Smith, challenge him again. And I do think it really just speaks to, you know, the changing nature of some of these districts and the fact that the last two elections, we've had really sort of interesting, in some ways unprecedented electorates. 2018, Democrats were super motivated, and this year we saw really both parties be very motivated.
So this one's barely over, but we're still thinking about a possible rematch in the future. Wow, we're looking.
You know me.
We know you. Zach Corser, we know Democrats lost ground in Congress after the vote, but how vital is it for them to claim as many seats as they still can? I imagine it's pretty darn important right about this point, right?
Well, I guess it depends on which House of Congress we're talking about. I mean, you know, the House of Representatives is a majoritarian institution. So even though there's a narrow majority for Democrats, Nancy Pelosi has the votes to securely be Speaker. And I think on a Biden agenda, she's got enough control to deliver votes. But I think this unexpectedly poor performance of House Democrats is exposing tensions that exist in her caucus right now between progressives, moderates, and the leadership. Progressives see that, you know, that their claims are that, you know, Pelosi isn't progressive enough. They need to press the progressive agenda in order to succeed. Moderates are complaining that defund the police and other sorts of themes that came out of this election actually hurt them this cycle. And you've sort of got the leadership in between, and a leadership that's looking older and less responsive to their membership. I think the real excitement, frankly, is going to be in the Senate because we don't know what's going to happen in Georgia, but there's at least some possibility. You know, we talked about, you know, the gang of nine, the gang of eight. There may be a gang of four that could develop in the Senate, you know, moderate Republicans like Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, maybe even moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin, who could, on key Biden priorities, combine to actually decide what gets passed in the Senate. So it's, you know, every vote counts, and we're in for some really interesting legislative activity in this next session.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that one. There's a lot to watch, especially out of Georgia. Well, meanwhile, in Orange County, Republicans Michelle Steele and Young Kim took back congressional seats occupied by Democrats. And Marisa, I'm really curious here. What was it about their campaigns, or was it this particular year? What was it that helped them reclaim those traditionally Republican-held seats?
Yeah, I think Orange County is a really interesting place to watch. And I'll start this by saying, you know, I did a story about those races, and I talked to the head of both the state Democratic and the state Republican parties, and they actually agreed on something, Austin, which is is a battleground now. I mean, I think that Democrats were super excited when they flipped all those seats. You know, they did hang on to Katie Porter's easily, to Mike Levin's easily. I think, you know, out in District 50, where Daryl Issa kind of carpetbagged in there and did win, but Amakampa Najjar gave him a run for his money. That's Eastern San Diego County. I think that whole kind of region is, you know, changing. And I think Michelle Steele and Young Kim have a couple things going for them. One is that they're known quantities. Michelle Steele's on the Board of Supervisors. Young Kim was an assemblywoman. You know, the Asian American vote in both those districts is strong and sometimes a little less partisan than we see other demographic groups. You know, I'm always hesitant to make broad generalizations about any racial group, but I do think that that may have helped both of them. And again, just like that seat we talked about up in northern Los Angeles County, these are razor's edge. I mean, none of the seats that Republicans have or may end up flipping, because there's also one in the Central Valley that hasn't been called yet. We're talking about 1-point races in most of these cases. So it's not as if this was a rout by Republicans, but I think it just shows that this is an electorate that is willing to potentially look at folks from both parties. You did see some vote splitting in Orange County where Biden actually outperformed the Democrats. So I think that is telling to some extent that, you know, people may have really disliked Trump or liked Biden, but maybe weren't as comfortable with the candidate or the sitting congressperson. But just like Northern LA, I think that these are going to be competitive seats, at least for the near future. And eventually they may be more safely blue seats, depending on demographics. But for now, we actually have some interesting races to look forward to in the future.
Really quickly, Zach, before we move on, the two Republican victors, as we just heard in both of those races, they are Asian American women. And with all the conversations that we have here about the future of really a waning GOP in California, does the future look a lot like Young Kim?
I mean, it could. Republicans this time focused on electing women. By looking at it today, they really hit rock bottom in 2018. They actually lost almost half their women members in that election. Mm. And Elise Stefanik and other Republican members came together and basically said, we need to get more women Republicans elected. And they had a lot of success. There's 13 women in the current Congress right now, Republican women. That's going to grow to 28 in 2021. And there's some firsts. There'll be the first Native American woman Republican, the first Iranian American woman in the GOP caucus. You know, nothing succeeds like success. So if Republicans see that a more diverse membership and more diverse candidates are a winning strategy, I think you're going to see more of that in 2022.
It's State of Affairs here on Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. Claremont McKenna's Zach Corser and KQED's Marisa Lagos are with me. Let's turn now and check in on Governor Newsom. He's had quite a week. And I want to kind of pull from the do as I say, not as I do files, which seems to be getting thicker these days. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Governor Newsom, he is taking plenty of heat for attending a private dinner party at a fancy Napa Valley restaurant recently with several people who I'm pretty sure aren't in his household. And he has apologized for it. But Marisa, we now have more details about what that dinner looked like, too. And on the national stage, it doesn't really seem like this is going away, is it?
I mean, eventually it'll go away, right? But no, this is definitely not a story that Gavin Newsom obviously wanted out there, and probably not one that he wanted to see this much shelf life on. I mean, I think to some extent he has himself and his communications office to blame, because as you noted, he kind of did that mea culpa, I believe on Monday at his news conference after this story had first broken the Chronicle.
Kind of buried it deep in there, though, I got to say.
Yeah, of course, he waited for the question on it. But then, you know, then the photos leaked and more information came out. And I think that, you know, it would have probably been wise for his office to just kind of come out and be a little bit more forthright about what had actually happened. That photo you talked about, it appears as if the party was inside some sort of structure. I don't think it's the regular restaurant. I think it might have been something they built. But, you know, it's just not a good look. I mean, we have spent, all of us, the last, what, 9-10 months huddling in our houses, trying to be as safe as possible. The governor, I think, until this moment had a lot of moral authority, because he has been, as opposed to a lot of Republican lawmakers and governors who kind of, you know, ignored or flouted or just outright rejected things like mask mandates and staying out of restaurants. He's been telling us all not to do this. And, you know, I don't think at that point it really matters too much that this is, you know, was legal under Napa County ordinance at the time. It just doesn't look great for him to be mixing with other folks, eating at a restaurant, and doing so in a not totally outside situation, if I'm being kind to characterize it.
Well, Zach, Marisa mentioned that moral high ground. So I'm really kind of wondering, from your perspective, does he lose some moral high ground on this one? And then, of course, could it affect how seriously Californians take these newly instituted measures that he just brought up yesterday?
Well, the timing is really bad. This is fairly counterproductive if the message he's trying to put out is that this is about saving lives. It's hard to argue about risk when the governor assumes, you know, a risk for something as trivial as an indoor restaurant, and he's asking for curfews and increased vigilance by Californians to avoid close contact. And look, we're coming into Thanksgiving and Christmas. People are still sort of exhausted by all the things that we've had to do to adjust to COVID. And if I remember back to Memorial Day and all the sort of hopes that people had, I know, well, I mean, after this election, I can barely remember yesterday. But back on Memorial Day, people were really getting tired of being cooped up, and there was this kind of false hope that the summer meant that this was over, and we saw a spike in outbreaks. And now we've got a double whammy here, where we're heading into the winter time. Where transmission is much easier, people are going to be indoors more, and there's a great deal of pressure to convene socially. So, you know, add on top of that a kind of false hope about a vaccine, and I say false in the sense that it's going to be months before most people are going to have access to this vaccine. So we've really got to take this seriously. So the timing is really, really bad.
Yeah, I want to wrap up with just the last 2 minutes that we've got here. Play a little bit of good news, bad news. And there's some good news despite all of the bad things that we have seen in recent weeks. California's budget forecast for the next 4 years now shows us starting off with a $26 billion windfall? Question mark. Marisa Lagos, what happened here?
Well, this is because we have this tax system that really relies heavily on capital gains and other things that wealthy people, the way wealthy people make money. So the LAO is saying that this is not a long-term thing, that we will face future deficits, but that, yes, in the near term, it could be actually as high as $40 billion or as low as $12 billion, depending on what happens over the next 18 months. And really, they're saying that this should only be spent on one time, maybe saving some of it into the rainy day fund, maybe using some of it for COVID-related expenses. But it is sort of, I think, some immediate good news, especially for schools that are really struggling to figure out ways to open up. And I just have to always point out that, you know, it's we were underfunding schools before. They were already struggling. And so, you know, the cuts that the Newsom administration and the legislature agreed upon, if, you know, the extra federal funding didn't come through, which it has not yet, may not be as deep. And it actually, there might be a bit of a windfall for schools. So good news out there for a lot of administrators.
Kind of covered both bases there. You got in the good news and you told us, sadly, temporary. That was the bad part, in case you were wondering. Zach Corser, last question to you with about a minute left. What does this say about California's tax policies and those sometimes controversial ideas about taxing more heavily the high earners out there?
Well, it shows you that there's a trade-off, right? Mm. There's ups and downs. We overshot the mark, that is to say the legislature did, in cutting back. And so we have this windfall. But doesn't take away from the fact that future revenues will continue to be volatile and react to what's happening in the stock market with capital gains and what's happening with high earners. So, you know, moving forward the next 3 years, I think really what we've bought ourselves is time, because this volatility is not going away. And the bad part, like Marissa was saying, of this report is that we've got a deficit in the next 3 to 4 years. And so we've basically bought ourselves some time to get our house in order and to think about what our budget priorities are and to try to stabilize our revenue. So it's good news, but it's tinged with the idea that there's a lot more work yet to be done.
I just want to live in good news land for a short period of time, Zach. I mean, come on. Come on, man. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Marissa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Highly recommended. Zach, Marissa, have a safe weekend. Be home by 10.
I'll be in bed by 10.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Austin.
See ya.
Coming up, there are now at least 2 COVID-19 vaccines that have shown promising results in trials. Though when they might become available in Southern California, well, that's kind of hard to say right now, right? But when they do, some UCLA researchers are out with a new model that could help public health officials distribute the vaccine effectively. And here's a key word, equitably. We'll hear more about that in 1 minute. You are back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. The coronavirus has now infected more than 11 million Americans and killed more than 250,000 people. But when we focus on statistics like those, it can actually be pretty easy to lose sight of COVID-19's impact on every person who gets sick. KPCC health reporter Jackie Fortier has the story of one Southern California man whose saga reminds us not only of how dangerous the virus is, but of how it may also do lasting damage to the people it infects.
In March, Tobin Nichols drove home from his part-time teaching job, and he just felt off. Nichols is a 50-year-old visual artist in L.A. As a diabetic, he's very aware of getting sick because he's immunocompromised.
I got the headache, I got the coughing, I got a weird sinus drainage, I got some stomach gurgling that was very strange.
After a few days, he suspected he had COVID-19. He headed to a local hospital, which at that time was the only place he could get tested. But when hospital workers took a sample, his blood oxygen levels were normal, so he didn't qualify for a test.
They sent me home and said, "You'll probably be okay in about a week. Just take Tylenol and rest."
He spent the next month in bed.
From then on, it was just full force. I was really ill. I couldn't breathe. I could barely walk. I wasn't eating very much.
Nichols lost 25 pounds.
It felt like someone had held me down and flossed my teeth really hard, because I would wake up and my entire jaw would just hurt.
His coughing fits left him struggling to breathe, and he had to sit down and catch his breath, walking the 15 feet from the bathroom to his bed.
I couldn't say more than 3 or 4 words because I couldn't get the breath.
The coronavirus affects almost every system in the body, including the nervous system. Nichols says it must have affected his because of something that happened a couple of times when he was trying to talk to his roommates.
I started trying to talk, and the words were just the wrong words, or for some reason my mouth wouldn't make the right shape to make the word I was thinking. It was sort of funny, but also concerning at the same time.
Some people who get infected don't develop symptoms, or they get a mild case of COVID-19. But for the millions who have gotten ill, many have also suffered from lingering and sometimes debilitating heart, lung, and nervous system impairments. Doctors have no way of knowing who will develop long-term health issues. So 8 months after Nichols came down with symptoms, I called him back to check in.
Hi, Jackie. How are you? I'm doing well. How are you?
He says he feels pretty good. You know, he takes his dog on 3-mile hikes and recently replaced his deck. But the roller coaster is far from over. Nichols says it takes him much longer to recuperate from those hikes, and he gets tired easily.
And I do still have trouble breathing. I've been trying to sort of stretch my lungs. I don't know if that's a term or not.
He's also noticed a persistent problem that he didn't have before he was infected with the virus. Sometimes he struggles to think clearly.
There are times where things just sort of become, I don't know, a little numb or a little frozen as far as sort of my mind goes. And I sort of will also sort of stare off into space a little bit at those times.
Nichols says each episode lasts about 10 minutes and he has to work to regain his focus.
It's just such a strange phenomenon that you sort of just go a little foggy. You just sort of can't concentrate, and what you're trying to do isn't really there.
Doctors are searching for answers as more patients report post-coronavirus cognitive impairment. While Nichols has improved somewhat, he's frustrated watching the pace of the pandemic pick up.
It's infuriating to me when people don't take it seriously, and they play with their lives and they play with other people's lives. Like, what you do in public is affecting other people at this point, and that's the part that's really important.
Blood tests show Nichols still has antibodies, but no one knows how long they'll last or if they make him immune. So he wears a mask everywhere he goes and does everything else he can to make sure he doesn't get the coronavirus again. 8 months later, he still isn't over his first infection. Covering health, I'm Jackie Fortier.
Well, we are again on high alert about the spread of the coronavirus, but there has been some good news on the vaccine front, so we can look forward to getting some relief sometime in the next year, hopefully. But how might it come to us? Let's get some answers from UCLA Professor of Health Policy and Management, Vicky Mays. And Professor Mays, when a vaccine is finally cleared for use, how does distribution usually work and who's in charge of that?
When we're talking about a distribution process, typically what we're looking at is people will put in an order for a vaccine. So if we were to talk about COVID-19, the states right now are trying to see how much COVID-19 can I get. And CDC has some kind of plan. I don't know it in detail. It has a plan about how many doses that it's going to give each state. And then from there, what happens is the state has another set of plans. So the state, for example, knows all the healthcare providers. The state knows the federally qualified health centers. The state knows what the requests will be from CVS and Ralph's and all the other places now that also want to give a flu vaccine. So the process really is to try and get it into the hands of the states, and for the states to kind of be the source of the distribution.
Now, when it comes to coronavirus vaccines, though, there are a few factors that one needs to consider. And a big one is that, for example, the Pfizer version, it needs to be kept very cold. And that seems like it could complicate the distribution process. I'm wondering, does it look like that to you, too?
Well, it could. But I think at this juncture, we're more interested in figuring out how to do something about that. I think it will just be another hoop that we have to jump through. And what it might mean is that we don't distribute it exactly the same way. So, for example, not every CVS or Rite Aid or Walmart or whatever is going to have the space to have a freezer that is a minus 20 freezer. Right now, as a matter of fact, I think they're about 6 weeks behind. There's so many orders in for the minus 120 freezer that, you know, it's about 6 weeks before I think people are going to get them. So it just means you need to think about other places, other ways. We've already started doing the vaccine distribution, even for the flu shot, differently. So you're seeing, for example, people driving up to places like Dodger Stadium or other open air places to get the flu vaccine. So I think we're in the middle of a time at which things are changing anyway.
So now that we understand that a little bit, let's talk about who should get it first, because I know your team has mapped out some of the most vulnerable communities in LA County that might be considered. Which neighborhoods are we talking about here?
Let's make a transition, because you're going from the vaccines to the neighborhoods, and there's an intermediary step that's really critical, and that is vaccinations. There's a difference. We can have a vaccine, but that's very different than people showing up and getting vaccinated. We have a lot of work to do. And that work really needs to start with thinking about what do we need to do to convince people that they need to be vaccinated. I don't know if you've seen some of the studies, but studies actually talk about there's anywhere from about 20% to 42% of people in this country who are skeptical of being vaccinated. Now, what the model that we have given will do is to tell you, well, who are priorities that we should probably be starting right now to educate about what the vaccine will and won't do, to really find out from those communities how they would like to receive it. We don't know a lot of those things in order to get at least a high enough rate of people vaccinated that we can bring these numbers down.
Wow. So I know that there's a lot of concern there. Based off of your research and what you've looked at within your organization, what are some of the areas and counties that need to start thinking about how to get this distributed? And what are the ones that are really most at risk and in need right now?
I think the way we start talking about this is to think about what are the characteristics that end up making people vulnerable. And what we see is that it's in these neighborhoods in which you have the greatest barriers to healthcare. It's in neighborhoods where there is a lack of access to things like computer broadband services, lower rates of health insurance, poor access to vehicles for travel around. So there's a certain type of characteristic that creates the vulnerability. It isn't the person for whom there is the vulnerability. It is a lot of the things that are in the neighborhood that end up creating a situation that makes the person more vulnerable. So, for example, in terms of South LA, you know, if we're going to talk about LA County, South LA and the San Fernando Valley are two areas that we can point to as areas that we have to start, I think, soon with this vaccination readiness. And it's not about starting with the vaccine, but it's about starting with a readiness and figuring out what are all the things that we need to do to make sure that we can reduce the vaccine hesitancy that people have.
We're speaking with UCLA Professor of Health Policy and Management, Vicky Mays. One thing that we've learned this year in general has just been, how do we get the word out to people? How do we get that messaging out to people, especially the people that are hit the hardest? And I'm looking at some of your report here. You looked at areas in South Los Angeles, eastern portions of the San Fernando Valley. And because a lot of those communities are predominantly communities of color, I get, in a sense, there's almost a social justice aspect to this, but it's also... Well, at the end of the day, it seems like immunizing these communities first will actually benefit all of society, right?
I think we need to step back and say, benefits for who and what created the vulnerability? The social justice issue isn't just making sure they receive the vaccine. The social justice issue is really to try and decrease the vulnerability. Because today it's COVID-19, and in a year it might be something totally different. If you look at COVID-19, the way in which it overlays with the same problems we have with HIV/AIDS is an incredible parallel. In HIV/AIDS, you have some of these same communities at higher risk, greater morbidity, and we haven't fixed things that decrease that. So that's why when COVID-19 comes in, you see a repeat, but it's an infectious disease that is airborne. So it just spread even faster. In HIV/AIDS, you had a behavioral component. So now what you have is not a behavioral component where you can get people to behave in a way in which is better. The problem is that I can behave quite well. It's what my neighbor does. And if my neighbor doesn't value me, my neighbor might not care. So when I go to my job and somebody else isn't wearing a mask, but I know that I might be very vulnerable because of a whole set of conditions, it says to me that you don't care about my life. You care about me as a worker. And then to find out that as a worker, when I get sick and I don't have any paid leave, I may not qualify. Latinx and African Americans have a much lower percentage of access to unemployment benefits compared to whites. So you begin to see that the social justice issue is not really just the vaccine, it's all these other things. And the question in America will be, what will we do? Are we only wanting to protect ourselves, or are we going to change the vulnerability that we have in the United States to groups of people being more at risk, especially when there's some kind of disaster or epidemic?
You know, you ask such an important question, and I have to say, I mean, as a person of color and hearing you say that, I don't hold up a lot of hope that there's going to be a lot of change, but maybe that's just based off of past performance. Do you have a lot of hope that things will change dramatically after this point?
I think we're in a moment, and that moment we really have to give to what has been happening in terms of Black Lives Matter. So we have a moment in which social justice issues are a little higher in the food chain these days. So some of that has the possibility to change some things. We've just had an election. And if in that election, we're able to have the federal government to function better than it has in the past, there is some opportunity that policies might be able to be changed. Now, some of the policies, there's federal policies and there's state-based policies. Unemployment benefits, that's really a state basis, though the federal government can do stimulus checks and other things to help. But I think we're at a moment where it's possible not to change hearts and minds, but it's possible to adjust policies.
That's UCLA Professor of Health Policy and Management, Vicky Mays. Vicky, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, just how well is Hollywood reflecting good mask-wearing etiquette this fall television season?
If you wanted to rank this show for its safety protocols, I'd put it somewhere between a Donald Trump rally and a Gavin Newsom dinner party.
So, not so good? KPCC's John Horn has been watching and judging. We will hear from him in 60 seconds after the news from Jackie Fortier. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. The fall TV season is underway, and there's a new star appearing on all kinds of shows. Face masks. Now, we know that the right way to wear a mask is to have it over your nose, right? Right. And that you should wear it the entire time when either indoors or in a place that's not your home, especially when you're in close proximity to others with whom you don't live. Yeah, I know. You know this. But there's a problem. Those facts aren't reflected in some fictional stories we can see right now. KPCC's John Horn has been flipping the channels to see how well TV writers and producers are following through on modeling the right mask usage. Hey, John.
Hey, Austin.
You got a sampling of what's out there so far, and I'm really interested to hear this. Let's start with Law and Order SVU. What did you see when masks were worked into the story?
Well, I'd say if you wanted to rank this show for its safety protocols, I'd put it somewhere between a Donald Trump rally and a Gavin Newsom dinner party. I mean, it is just terrible. And I don't know if an episode of a fictional TV series can be a super spreader event, but if so, this is it. So NBC's Law and Order has always been kind of a rip from the headlines kind of show. And the new season starts with a scene essentially replicating the call made by Amy Cooper. Remember back in May in New York Central Park, she was complaining about a black man who was bird watching.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the start. And while there are masks and hand sanitizers and social distancing, Law & Order SVU gets everything wrong. So I'm going to play a scene from a hospital where some investigators are talking to a doctor about somebody who's been assaulted.
Eric's one of the good guys. Who the hell would do this? You know him?
Yeah, he was a resident. They bumped him up during COVID to work ER. I'm sorry.
So the doctor takes off his mask and his shield to talk to the investigators. No. There's a scene where the police chief is wearing a mask and he comes up to talk to one of the characters and he removes his mask. There's a scene between a DA and another police officer where they're essentially screaming toe-to-toe, like face-to-face. I can imagine they're like spitting at each other and neither one is wearing a mask. So they're trying to be topical and they have people talk about the pandemic and people use hand sanitizers and you can see plexiglass screens, but they don't model good behavior. And the bigger the star on the show, the less likely they are to wear a mask. So maybe part of it is vanity, but if they're trying to send the message like, this is the real world and this is how you have to behave, everything they say is 100% wrong.
Wow. Okay. But I understand that you also looked at what's been happening on The Real Housewives of Orange County. How did they do with mask wearing, John?
First of all, I want to make sure I can put in for combat pay for watching Real Housewives.
Granted.
On this Bravo series, I guess, you know, the way they film it, it's a little bit like the NBA bubble, except the participants here have no visible talent for anything. And there's behavior and references to the pandemic in the show. But the thing that's important about a show like Real Housewives is the people in it are really big influencers. And some of the housewives have huge social media followings where they behave badly. So there is a Real Housewife named Kelly Dodd, and there are photos of her at a bridal shower where guests weren't wearing masks or practicing social distancing. She's also been very skeptical about mask wearing. She said, I think she has 900,000 Instagram followers, where she said, it's not a pandemic anymore. Did you read the CDC numbers?
Wow.
So, you know, it's not like the show is telling the wrong thing, but its members are telling the wrong thing, or some of them. And I think that's important because people do model some behaviors after reality TV stars, for better or for worse.
I'm talking to KPCC's John Horn, whose critic pen has obviously been sharpened by this pandemic so far. And he's been watching for mask usage on television. And John, those shows were the goofuses, but you did see a show that was the gallant and worked in masks the right way. Tell us about The Conners.
Yeah, The Conners did a good job. And I'm also going to give a little shout out to Black-ish. Now, Black-ish does talk about the pandemic. There's a scene where the family has to stay at home because the schools are closed, and it's a comedy, but they're dealing with like real life issues. And even though they're not really practicing good behavior, there's a wedding rehearsal dinner later in the season, and nobody's wearing a mask, even though there's, you know, like more than a dozen people there. It at least is talking about like the impact. The Conners, I think, is really interesting because not only do they start with everybody wearing masks and really practicing good social distancing and good protocols, but they also talk about the real impact the pandemic is having on some people. So here's a scene from The Conners where they're talking about like what is happening to people in the real world, even though this is obviously a scripted show.
So, Dad, have you heard anything from the bank? I mean, they can't take our house during COVID, can they?
They're so busy repossessing other houses, maybe they'll forget about us.
Yeah, they have their pick. Hey, should we grab that four-bedroom Cape Cod or Tobacco Road over there with a chicken coop out back?
Is Mark here?
I saw you ride up on your bike. Show me your test.
Here. See? Negative.
I mean, I think they're really after something. And something that's important about The Conners is this is a show that is not kind of an elitist show. It's a show that plays well across the country. And obviously, the pandemic is spiking nationwide, but there are a lot of states in the middle of the country where The Conners is probably very popular. And this is a good message. Like, this, these are the steps you have to take. And also to remind people that it's not just about you can't have too many people over for Thanksgiving. People are losing their jobs. People are losing their homes. And this is one of the real impacts of the pandemic.
Well, John, I know we're taking Hollywood to task a bit here, but from a cultural standpoint, how important is it that TV shows demonstrate some model mask wearing, maybe doing it the right way?
I mean, I think it's really important. I mean, I think popular culture has a tremendous impact on the way people see the world. And that's why things like representation are really important. Mm. And, you know, you can think back, you know, probably whatever it was, 40 years ago, a movie like Flashdance comes out in the early 80s, and everybody starts wearing kind of oversized sweatshirts off the shoulders. The New York Times quoted an associate professor of communications and media studies at Emmanuel College in Boston named Mark Flynn. And what he said about reality TV is that reality TV research has been linked to health behavior for the past couple of decades. So people do learn something from these shows, and they learn good things. And it looks like right now they can learn some really bad things.
Well, John, I'm really curious. As someone who's reported on Hollywood for many years at this point, I'd imagine there are some challenges when it comes to working masks into these stories. I'm wondering who's consulting these shows to make sure that it's done right.
Well, most shows now have kind of a coronavirus expert or administrator on set. And that's largely to make sure that the actors and crew are behaving safely, that people are, you know, separated. And obviously, in certain shows, the actors have to be in close proximity to one another. And then there's the creative issue. Like, how do you incorporate, you know, the pandemic into a story? Do you do it at all? Is, you know, entertainment supposed to be escapist and you're not going to reference the real world? And then there's the question of, like, how do you perform? Like, do you want to see actors in masks if they're not really talking about the pandemic? And as I said about Law and Order, the bigger the star, the less likely they were to wear a mask. I think audiences want to see actors' faces. And, you know, in these shows, sometimes they can't.
Well, I like to take the long view, John, and I like to think about how shows set in a different era, they have to call in a specialist to make sure directors get things right. And so now I'm really wondering if in like 20, 30 years that there will be a mask expert for shows set in 2020 and, you know, probably 2021.
I think there should be, and I think there could be better now. I mean, I think if you look at the way these shows are getting things wrong, if they're talking to experts, they're ignoring their advice, or they're making a decision that they don't want to deal with it. But I think the thing that's important is that when you mention the pandemic in a show, you better deal with it. So, yes, I think you're right. I hope people start modeling better behavior now, because a lot of these episodes have been filmed after the pandemic, and they should be better. I mean, they really should be better, or they shouldn't even try.
That's KPCC's John Horan. He hosts the podcast Hollywood, the sequel for LAist. Hey, John, thanks so much for making the time, man.
Thank you much.
Stay-at-home orders from the state kick in Saturday night. That means non-essential businesses got to close their doors by 10 p.m. But what if you get hungry at 10:01? The new rules of late-night noshing, that's just ahead. We're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most places you get your podcasts. I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. The state issued a limited stay-at-home order yesterday, mimicking LA County's mandate earlier this week that all non-essential businesses stay closed from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. the next morning. But what does this all mean if I'm hungry after 10 o'clock at night? LAist food editor Elena Shatkin has some answers. Hey, Elena.
Hi there.
Restaurants have to close down at 10. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that in the late night, you're going to starve, Austin.
Oh,
that's all
no.
there is to it.
I was worried to say that.
I'm kidding. It means that after 10 p.m., restaurants can't serve patrons for dine-in service, which is mostly or entirely outdoor these days anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're finishing up at a restaurant 5 or 10 minutes after the curfew, you'll probably be fine. But you won't be able to linger beyond that. Restaurants will stop, you know, taking reservations, you know, after a certain hour, things like that.
So just to be clear, I can still pick up food and maybe even order and delivery, right?
We think so. It's a little bit unclear, to be honest. At a press conference yesterday, California's Health and Human Services Agency Secretary, Dr. Mark Galli, said the back door to takeout and delivery, and that's a quote, could stay open after 10 p.m. But he didn't offer more details. And also, if people are required to stay home after 10 p.m., you know, except for essential things, it's unclear what that means for delivery drivers.
Wow. So what about grocery stores, Elena?
Don't worry about those. They're classified as an essential business, so they can still stay open after 10 p.m., just like pharmacies and a handful of other essential businesses.
So now food trucks and carts, they do big business late at night. I'm a frequent patron, so I should know. But if people can't gather past 10, how might this impact their businesses?
Well, it's going to be pretty rough for those businesses. Now, in terms of health and safety, food trucks are regulated slightly differently from restaurants. But in this case, it seems like they're going to have to follow the same restrictions as restaurants, shutting down at 10 p.m. And as you point out, for food trucks and carts who do the bulk of their business, you know, selling bacon-wrapped hot dogs to people who come out of bars or things like that, this is going to be a big issue. Although, you know, I certainly haven't seen as many late night street food vendors as I did before the pandemic.
You know, this pandemic has been really hard on restaurant owners. I don't think I need to tell anybody that. But with about 30 seconds left, Elena, I'm kind of wondering, what have you heard from eateries around LA about these new rules? It has to be a blow, right?
It's a huge blow. And it's going to be the biggest blow for small mom and pop places, the kind that don't have a lot of indoor space, because in many cases, they ramped up their takeout, they expanded their outdoor eating areas just to try to get enough customers in the door, you know, to keep the lights on. But then if they have to reduce the number of people they can seat, it's going to be just another major blow in a year of huge blows for restaurants.
Gosh, such a hard year. Well, thank you so much for letting us know what's happening there. That's LAist's Elena Shatkin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about you, but all these new rules are kind of making my head spin. Thank goodness, though, the weekend is here, and we have a few ideas on how you can spend the time.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and Austin, our listeners know to take it very seriously about staying home unless absolutely necessary as coronavirus rates spike up.
Of course.
They want to keep themselves and their family and neighbors safe. But we all need to take a break this weekend too, so we've got a great sampling of things to do that won't burst your social bubble and hopefully help you relax.
All right, so first, in these unsettling times, what's something to pick up my spirits, Leo?
First, a little holiday cheer.
Yes.
So, as you know, Austin, theme parks have been mostly shuttered for the past several months, but a few have actually reopened with new formats to still welcome guests and safely. Starting today into the new year, Magic Mountain hosts Holiday in the Park. It's this drive-through experience, and so the park has been redesigned with millions of lights along with holiday music pumping through the air. Costume characters will also be at various different stops to wave to you as you cruise by. This is kind of a really great way to check out some festive displays from the safety of your car. And it all wraps up by 10 o'clock, so you'll be back safely at home by the time that late night curfew sets in. So to go, you must buy your tickets ahead of time online, and it's $20 per person.
Okay, then what can I do if I really need a laugh?
So you can attend the next performance of Mortified. So this is this ongoing series where people go up on stage, or in this case lately, go to a Zoom room, to share their stories from their past that make them mortified, but now they can look back on and laugh, so you can too. Tomorrow at 6, the theme is angst-giving, very appropriate. And I've been to a few of these. People read from things like their old diaries, poetry they've written when they were really angsty teenagers, you know, stuff that years later seems super cringy, but are amazing to laugh at right now. So when you want to go, that's online and it's free.
You might find me at that one, Leo. I've got some stories. Well, finally, what can I do? Some stories. We'll leave it at that. Finally, Leo, what can I do if I need to let loose and have a good time again?
Well, once Mortified finishes, you can switch over to check out the final installment of Skirball Stages. This is that music series hosted by the Skirball Center, and it wraps up with a virtual concert of one of my favorite LA bands, Las Cafeteras. They always have this great upbeat music that makes me want to move, and they're also going to be joined by Grammy-nominated Brazilian singer Zenia Franca. The concert starts at 8, and it's free via the Skirball's YouTube channel. Now, Austin, there are still a bunch more events for people to go to online. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
All right, that's KPCC's Minister of Fun, Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
Thanks, Austin. I'll get that story about your cringe now.
Oh, boy. Those stories, they go with me to the grave. That's it for Take Two this week. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez, who's enjoying some very well-deserved time off, but I will be back with you next week. Hey, let's hear it for all the people who make Take Two possible. Lea Duran, Gabriel Donatov, Olivia Richard, Itzi Quintanilla, Darby Maloney, Marina Pena, our engineer, Hazmik Pahosian, and our senior producer, Megan Larson. Hey, stay safe out there, everybody.